Gentlemen, I met last night and chatted with him a little while and talked to him a little while this morning. He made a big impression on me, and I think you'll enjoy his message. Mr. Bill O. from Brownwood, Texas. Bill. Well, howdy, everybody. Before I get started, I'd like to thank the committee for asking Arbutus and I up here to this beautiful place. I consider it a great honor to be chosen to come up here. It's one of the highlights of my AA life. I am Bill O'Neill, an alcoholic. By the grace of God and by living by the 12 steps and the 12 traditions of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober since October the 21st, 1951, for which I'm very thankful. Now, lest y'all get to considering trying to think how long that is and miss what I have to say, I'll tell you it's 32 years, 9 months, and 7 days. I was in Detroit, Michigan, back in the early 60s, and one of the up there with Arbutus on an Al-Anon rally, and one of the AA members took me to his group there in Detroit. Regular meeting, and there was about 12, 14 people there, and it was just a discussion meeting. We were sitting around the table, and when it came my turn and the chairman called on me, I introduced myself like that, gave my sobriety date. There was a red-headed guy sitting right across the table from him with angry brown eyes, and he said, "What are you doing, bragging or confessing?" I said, "Well, I guess I'm doing both." He said, "Well, we say up here the man that got up the earliest this morning has got the longest sobriety." I said, "Yeah, we got a lot of liars down there in Texas, too." That's the reason we give a dry date, because we found out down there that if the man doesn't give his dry date, in all probability, he doesn't have one, so we established one. They told me that when you talk in AA, you tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Well, everybody in here knows what it was like. It was unadulterated misery. I was 19 years old before I ever tasted whiskey. I was already out of high school. I was working over at Mule Shoe, Texas, with two of my brothers building houses. Our father was a building contractor. We was raised in the business. And I was running around with a cousin of mine who was still in high school, and his chum was the sheriff's son who was in high school. I was buddying around with them, and they came to me one day and they said, "Bill, Hilton has built a new hotel over at Clovis, and they're having the opening of it next Saturday. And they have a big-name band there that's going to play for a dance. Let's go over there." And I said, "No, I don't want to go to a public dance. I'd never dance publicly." And they said, "Oh, yes, it's a big-name band. It was Glenn Miller or one of the big names. I've forgotten who the band was." And they worked on me all week. Finally, Saturday morning, Morris, who was the sheriff's son, came around to me, and he said, "Bill, Dad's got some whiskey locked up in one of the cells down in the courthouse." He said, "Now, I'm the janitor down there, and I don't have a key to that cell, but those bars are wide enough to stick your arm through, but that whiskey's sitting way back over in the corner. We ought to be able to figure out a way to rake a pint of that whiskey out of there." He said, "Let's go down and see if you can figure out how to get it." So we went down there, and I saw I could stick my arms through the bar. And I said, "Well, that's easy." And I went back out on the job where we was building the house and got some of that little white sash card rope that we use for window weights, a little white rope about as big as a little finger. I cut off about 10 foot of it, and I made a rope out of it and went down there, and I lassoed a pint of that whiskey over there and pulled it through the bars. And he said, "Now, when we get over there to that dance, you can take a few drinks of that, and you won't be afraid to get on a public dance floor." I said, "All right." See, the reason they wanted me to go with them, I was making $5 a day working with my brothers, and they were in school, and they weren't earning any money. This was way back yonder when a dollar was a dollar, and the tickets were $2 a piece, and they didn't have the money. So they were promoting me to buy the tickets for. My cousin got his dad's car, and we took off Clovis' owner 40 miles from Muleshoe. We drove over there and parked on the parking lot. They opened that pint of whiskey and handed it to me and said, "Now take a big drink." Well, I took a couple of big swallows of it and gagged and almost vomited, and I said, "My God, do you drink rotten stuff like that?" And they said, "Just wait a minute." They each took a drink, and they handed me that bottle again, and I took another great big slug. And they said, "Come on, let's go." I got out of the car and started for the front door of that hotel, and boom, just like that, I become 6'4", the best-looking man in West Texas, and the world was beautiful. And I said, "Who are you?" And this personality that had hit me said, "I am the genie of the bottle. You've been looking for me all your life." You see, I'm one of 11 children, and as I said, my father was a building contractor, but he couldn't make enough money building houses, so he also farmed, and we'd farm in a section of land, and I had to get up at 3:30 every morning, get the chores done, sop the hogs, milk the cows, and feed the horses, and be in the field by sunup. And I didn't like that. So in the second or third grade, our school teacher had a reader that told the story of Aladdin and his magic lamp. Seems that Aladdin had this lamp, and he could rub it, and that genie would appear and say, "What will you have, sir?" And Aladdin would tell him what he wanted, and the genie would get it for him. So I started looking for me a lamp like that picture that was in that storybook that Aladdin had. I wanted a genie that I could make appear, and when he'd say, "What do you have, sir?" I'd say, "Get out there and do those chores for me, and get in that field and do that plowing or chopping of that cotton, and so I can be like my cousins who lived in town. They didn't have to work." And I had looked all over West Texas trying to find me a lamp like that. Well, here I am, past 19 years old. I took 3 or 4 big drinks of whiskey, and boom, that genie appeared for me. He said, "I am the genie of the bottle. I'm even more powerful than Aladdin's genie of the lamp. I won't do things for you. I will give you the ability to do them yourself. What do you want?" I said, "I want to be the best dancer on that floor." He said, "You shall be." I walked into the lobby of that hotel, walked over to the cigar counter and said, "Give me a package of Lucky Strikes." I had never smoked before in my life, but I thought a man of my distinction ought to be able to smoke. I lit a cigarette. We went up on the mezzanine. I bought the tickets. I'm standing there puffing this cigarette and looked the crowd over, and I saw a beautiful blonde looking like Betty Grable sitting over there. Big 6'4" cowboy standing there talking to her. I put my cigarette out, walked across that floor and pushed him aside, and I said, "Come on, honey, let's show him how it's done." I was the Fred Astaire of West Texas. Man, I really cut me a rug on that dance floor. Well, after a dozen or so sets, that whiskey started dying down in me, and I went downstairs and got me another big slug of it and come back upstairs. And that's the last I remember until the next morning I came to behind my, this was in the wintertime. It was in the latter part of November, early part of December that this dance is going on. And there was snow on the ground. I came to in a snowbank behind my brother's house there in Muleshoe. That new suit that I had bought is dirty and stinking. I am sick. I am so sick. I crawled in the house and I called my cousin. I said, "What in the world happened? How come me laying in a snowbank out here? What did y'all do to me?" He said, "Don't you remember last night?" I said, "No, of course I don't remember. I remember I was going to the dance, and I remember dancing with that beautiful blonde, but I don't know what happened." He said, "Well, you went down and got another shot of that whiskey, and you was getting pretty drunk, so we thought we'd sober you up a little, and we carried you across the street and fed you a bowl of chili, and you went back up there, and you was dancing with that blonde again, and you vomited all over her, all over yourself, and dominoed right in the middle of the dance floor. And said it made us mad. We carried you downstairs and throwed you in the rumble seat, and we finished the dance, and when we brought you home, you were still out, so we just throwed you over in the snow, thinking you'd get up and go on in the house. You mean you just now come to?" Oh, sick. I was so sick. I couldn't even drink water. And for 3 months, the smell of alcohol would make me violently ill. And like I said, I was working with my brothers, and part of my job was to do the painting, And back in those days, we used lots of shellac on the interior of the house. And my other brother had to do all of the shellacking because we cut that shellac with alcohol, and that smell of that alcohol would make me violently ill. But the next time that I faced a difficult situation, I remembered that I had found a genie in that bottle, that I could solve all problems and all difficulties. Now, I forgot about that sickness. I put that in the back of my mind. It didn't enter my head that another drink of alcohol. So I called on alcohol again to give me the ability to do what I wanted to do, to be what I wanted to be. And every time it made me violently ill, and I would get drunk and pass out. And it was periods of months before I could, in between drunks, in the beginning. But I always forgot that sickness. I always forgot the trouble that alcohol got me into, because as you all know, eventually it started getting me into trouble. But I wouldn't remember that. I would remember that feeling of elation, that feeling of well-being, that feeling that I was king of the mountain, as I heard a man say. I was lord of all I surveyed any time I could get a few drinks within me. So I went back to it and went back to it and went back to it. Christmas Eve night of 1935, I had borrowed my sister's car there in Abilene. I was headed for Lubbock. I'd been working there in Abilene as a painter at 2 bits an hour for a solid year and hadn't touched alcohol in any form, because I knew if I ever took a drink, I'd waste my money, and I was saving my money to get married, the little girl I'd been going with about 4 years. I saved $100 that year, borrowed my sister's car, and was to go up on Christmas Eve and pick her up in Lubbock, and we were going over to New Mexico where there wasn't any waiting period and get our license and get married. My sister said to me, she said, "Drive us out to the country club before you leave. We have a company party out there. And then you can take the car and go on." Got to the country club. She said, "Don't you want to come in and say, wish your friends Merry Christmas?" I went in the country club to see some of the friends that were out there for a Christmas party. One of them said, "Bill, you should have one drink for the road." Well, I hadn't had a drink in a year, so I went in to have a drink for the road. Midnight, my sister came in the bar and said, "I thought you was going to Lubbock to get married." I said, "I am." She said, "Not tonight. You're too drunk." I said, "Let's go home. You can get up in the morning and go." We went home. She tossed the keys on the dresser after I got in bed and said, "Now, you can get up in the morning and leave, but don't you drive like you are now." I promised her I would. I waited until they got to bed, and I sneaked out of the house and went down to an all-night service station that I knew there. It sold whiskey and bought a pint of whiskey and took a couple of big slugs and headed west and 5 miles out of town. I ran over an old boy and demolished his car and demolished my sister's car, broke my jaw, knocked out all my teeth, cut my left eyeball wide open, and that eye had to be removed. I hadn't had a drink in a year, but I was under the impression that one or two for the road wouldn't hurt me. Of course, I never did marry that little gal, because she said, "This is the last straw. We've been trying for 4 years to get married, and every time something happens, you can forget it." I didn't take a drink for almost a year there, the whole year of 36. The latter part of the year, a friend of mine came through. I was completely crippled. You see, I had an eye out. I had a broken jaw, or I had a broken jaw. The doctor said it, and I had to have it reset, because this doctor that they took me to first didn't like drunks disturbing him on Christmas Day. He didn't even wash the eye out, so it got infected and had to be taken out. He didn't clean my mouth out, and where this jaw was broken, he didn't even set the bone. He just lapped it over and sewed it together. 3 days later, my sister came down from Lubbock and took me up there and got me a doctor that re-broke that jaw and set it properly. But I was crippled. You see, I was one-eyed. I wore a patch over that eye. A friend of mine had joined a magazine company and was selling magazine subscriptions, and he came through Texas, said, "Bill, I got a fine job for you." I said, "Oh, I can't do that, wearing this patch and all." He said, "There's a company in Denver, Colorado, that makes eyes. We'll go through there and get you a glass eye. They can fit you. You can sell these magazines, and you can make good money. That 2 bits an hour is no money at all. You can make $10-15 a day. Well, in 36, man, that was big money. So I joined the magazine crew and started selling magazines. Went through Denver, and they fitted me with a glass eye and kept my prescription there, where all I'd have to do was just call them or write them, and they'd send me eye. I was traveling all over the United States. We worked every little town in West Virginia back in 36, 37, 38. Pennsylvania, all of these towns up here. Our office was in New York City. And either 30, latter part of 36 or the early part of 37, I guess it was, our office offered a weekend in Indianapolis for the speed races to the manager that produced the most business over a period of 3 months. Well, me and two other men won it. We went into Indianapolis with a paid weekend, hotel bill, tickets to the speed races, and the whole works paid for by the company. We got in, of course, a couple of days early, checked in the hotel, and, of course, started drinking down in the Rathskeller. And that's as far as we ever got. We just stayed there and drank around the clock. About the third day we were in there, we run out of money. Back in those days, you had to have money to get anything. You couldn't charge it to the hotel bill. You had to have the money to pay for it. We run out of money. Well, we told the bartender, and at that time, too, you could only buy whiskey by the bottle. You couldn't buy it by the drink, and it was $14 a bottle. And we told him, bring us another bottle, and we'd pay for it the next morning. It was about midnight, and the manager had gone to bed. We had money at the desk in the safe, but we couldn't get it at midnight. And this bartender said, I can't charge things to you boys. Well, he said, we're in the hotel. We've been here 3 days. One of these boys is with me was a pretty good con artist. He said, you've seen us around here. You know that we're here, and we know we'll pay you in the morning. We got to have some whiskey. I'm sorry, I can't go. Unless you got security. Well, Hi says, we got plenty of security. And he said, all right, put the whiskey up. He said, Bill will give you his left eye. Well, this bartender had been watching me for 3 days. He didn't know I had a glass eye. He said, well, if you want one that bad, just take the eye out. And I just picked up there and took that glass eye out and wrapped it in a napkin and handed it to him. He brought us the whiskey. But that gave me an idea. Man, I scattered glass eyes from New York to San Francisco and from Chicago to Houston, Texas. Because, you see, I was buying them at $5 a piece, ordering them a dozen at a time because they were glass. And I'd run up a $50, $60, $70 bar bill, you know, on a glass eye as security. That was just one of the defects of character that I wondered how I was going to make amends for when I got sober. I was telling that up north somewhere one time. The man came to me and he said, Bill, don't worry about picking up all those glass eyes or making amends for that. Said, all of those bartenders got more than their money's worth out of that. Said, there's a bar in one of the big hotels there in Chicago that I used to stay in. Said, he's got that glass eye framed behind the bar, and he's got a sign there. Anytime you get desperate enough for a drink that you'll give one of your eyes for it, you can have it. He said, but I run, and I run, and I run. You see, I always thought that everything would be better somewhere else. Eventually got my arbutus and I got married. I hired her to sell magazines, and she sold them so good I decided I'd better keep her, so I just married her and took her all over the United States selling magazines with me. And our children started coming along, so we quit the road and settled in Cincinnati, Ohio, where all four of the kids were born. I went to work for Holland Furnish Company up there. I made awfully good money with Holland Furnish Company, but my drinking was getting worse and was getting worse and was getting worse. I know there in Cincinnati I got to where I thought that I was such a drunk I didn't want people to see me. So I'd sneak down the alleys and go in the back door of our office so that they wouldn't know, you know, that here was a drunk coming to work with a hangover. After I'd been sober 3 or 4 years, I went back to see the manager there in Cincinnati that I worked for, Holland, that I worked for. And I said, "Kelly, you'll be glad to know that I've been in AA 5 years sober." He said, "What do you mean, Bill?" I said, "Well, Lord, man, I was a drunk out of this world. I used to sneak through the alley and come in the back door so that you wouldn't see me and wouldn't know I was drinking." He said, "Bill, I didn't even know you drank." And I worked for him 3 years, and I thought he thought I was the biggest drunk in the country. But I was hiding it from people, I thought. Of course, Kelly, I found out later, was too busy in other things to keep up with his salesman very good, and as long as I produced, in which I did, you know, a drunk has to work extra hard and extra long sometimes to produce as much as ordinary people, and that's what I did. I excelled at selling everything that I sold. I know when I first went into Cincinnati and cut the magazine company, I went to work for a home equipment company, selling innerspring mattresses, dishes, Rogers silverware, and all things that the housewife needed, because the Depression was just coming, getting over with, and they had a plan whereby that the housewife could buy this innerspring mattress or a set of dishes or linens or whatever she needed for the house. She could buy it at 25 cents down and 25 cents a week. And of course, it was just like shooting fish in a barrel. I made $5 on every deal that I sold, and I'd sell 20, 25 deals a day. And I'd been working for them for several months, and Friedman, the sales manager, told me one morning, said, "Bill, let's go down to the warehouse and count the mattresses." Well, I had gone down there with him a time or two before. The warehouses were down on the river separating Kentucky from Cincinnati. And usually when we went down there, our building was right in the middle of about 50 buildings there. We'd parked right at the back of our building. But this morning he didn't. He parked up where the building started. And we went out to the front of them and walked on the walk and it faced the river going down to our building. And as we were walking along, I noticed men huddled up between these buildings. And I'd glance down at them. They're sitting there, and it was as cold as it could be. And they were all huddled up there. And I passed a group of about 3 or 4 men there, and I noticed one of them's face was bleeding. And I went over there and looked at him. And he had an ear, and his nose was off, and they were bleeding. And I looked at another, and he had 3 fingers is off. And I said, "Mr. Friedman, look here. What in the world is this?" He said, "O'Neill, that's what I brought you down here to see." He said, "These are winos and sternos. They get panhandled during the day and they get by a can of sterno or a bottle of wine. They get drunk and they have no place to stay. So in the night, they huddle up between these buildings to keep from freezing. And the rats come out of the river and eat them." He said, "That's what I wanted you to see. That's what's going to happen to you if you don't get out of that bottle." I said, "Oh, no, it won't happen to me." And that genie that I had discovered and I had been calling on all these years spoke up within me. He said, "Oh, yes, that is going to happen to you." He said, "All of these years, I've been your slave. But from here on out, you're going to be my slave. And as my slave, you can't have a home. You can't have friends. You can't have a job. You're going to be just like these men here." And I said, "You'll never get me like that." And I didn't take a drink for 2 days. I started fighting him then. I run all over the country. I wasn't going to be a slave of alcohol. I tried everything. I went one time to see a priest up in Canada who was on the radio, Father Coughlin. I tried every denomination of the religions. Of course, I was raised in the Baptist church and had cousins that were in brother-in-laws and all that were denominations of the other churches. But I heard about this Father Coughlin and about the good work he did, so I took off and went up into Canada to find him to see if he could save me and get me out of that bottle. But I never was able to get to him. I don't know whether he'd have been able to or not. I never could find him up there. But I searched everywhere. I did everything. And like I say, I was always searching for greener pastures. I drank up Cincinnati, Ohio, a town of 3 million people, because I thought everybody in that big city knew that I was a drunk. And I had an awful good job with Holland Furnace Company. But I went back to Texas. And, of course, the same thing happened there. I stayed drunk 3 or 4 months, long enough to get my wife and kids down there with me, and as soon as they got there, well, I went back to drinking. And I finally decided that, well, I could get out of the bottle if I'd go back home to Brownwood. See, as a boy of 14, I had run off from my dad and gone to Brownwood, and my mother's brother, my uncle, had taken me in, raised me, and sent me through school. And they were good people, good church people and all. I thought, well, if I could get back down to Uncle Luther, I wouldn't drink. So I went down and put the proposition to him, if I could come to Brownwood, then I could quit drinking. And he agreed with me. He loaned me the money to buy a little house and to buy a piece of land right next adjoining him. This land belonged to an old rancher, and the rancher had been fighting with the city over city taxes for 20 years. And so I bought a whole city block from him for $1, providing we'd get the city off of his back for all of those back taxes. Well, Uncle Luther had been county clerk there for 16 years, and he made a deal with the city that we'd allow him to cut an alley through this property for the back taxes. So I got that land for $1, and Uncle Luther loaned me the money to buy a little house, move in there on it, and we're right next door to them. I think I made 3-4 months without a drink. But I, you see, every time that I quit drinking, just put the plug in the jug. I didn't change me in any way, and I didn't change my ways of living. So I would become so miserable, I couldn't stand it, and I'd have to drink to get out of that misery. I couldn't not drink. But I'm working for a company in Fort Worth down there. I go in to get my check. Of course, they usually would mail it out, but I couldn't wait for them to mail it out. And I went in one Thursday to get the check. Told Arbutus I'd be back home that night. I got down there, and for some unknown reason, I stopped and took a drink. I get home about 4 days later. But something happened there in Fort Worth on this trip. I come to myself about 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm in the Blackstone Hotel there in Fort Worth, and I'm wondering why I'm there, because I'm supposed to be back in Brownwood. But I get up around 6 o'clock, and I go down looking for a bellboy because I need a drink bad. And when I get downstairs, well, I find the cop standing there in the lobby, and the manager of the hotel came over and caught me by the arm, took me over to this cop, said, "Here he is, officer. Take him with you." Well, I said, what are you taking me for? What have I done? And they're fixing to tell me, and two well-dressed men walked out of the coffee shop. And they walked over, and one of them got a manager by the arm, the other one got the cop by the arm, led him off and talked to him for a few minutes. And then they came back over to me, and they said, "Mr. O'Neill, let's go get your bag, and you go over with us, and we'll help you." I said, "Go where?" And he said, "Well, there's a little hotel over here on 10th Street. We want to take you over there and see if we can help you." I said, "Why would you want to help with me? Who are you?" And they said, "Well, we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it seems that you've been having trouble with your drinking, and we want to help you." And I said, "Who told you I was having trouble with my drinking?" He said, "Well, the manager of the hotel and that cop there says that you caused quite a scene in here last night, and they're taking you to jail. Now, you got a choice. You can go with us, and we'll help you sober up, or you can go with the cop and go to jail. Just make up your mind." I said, "Well, I'll go with y'all." So they took me over to that little hotel, and these two men sat with me all day, explaining to me about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And incidentally, back in those days, they didn't torture you. About every hour, they'd give me a drink of whiskey, a little one. And they'd tell me some more about the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And about 6 o'clock in the evening, well, two more men came in, and these two left. These guys stayed with me till midnight, and two more men came in at midnight, and they stayed with me till the next morning. 3 days and nights, these six men were there with me at all times, telling me about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. On the third night, they took me to an AA meeting. And a man got up there and said, "By the grace of God, he'd been sober 4 years." And I punched one of these guys who sat in the meeting. I said, "He's a liar," because the man didn't explain that he'd been sober 4 years until he had talked 10 or 15 minutes, and he had told some pretty horrendous stories about his drinking episodes. And I said, "If he drank like that, he couldn't possibly be sober for 4 years." The man said, "Be quiet. Just listen to him." And after the meeting is over, and this
Said, we want to give you this big book. I said, how much is it? You don't give me nothing. So I bought the big book. And they told me to study it. And I assured them I would. And they said, now, if you get in trouble, you come back down here. Well, I took the big book and I tore off home to Brownwood, 125 miles west. Now, Arbutus never gave me any trouble in my drinking days, because I did my drinking on the road. I traveled, and I'd stay gone all week and come in on the weekends. And if I got too drunk to drive myself in, I'd hire somebody to drive me home. She'd put me in the back bedroom. She'd feed me a glass or two of warm salt water to clean me out, and then she'd sober me up on potato soup. I had no trouble with her. But this day, I'd been gone 3 days and gone down there to get the check so that we'd have groceries in the house. I put that book under this stub, and I had my suitcase in my right hand, and I go up to the house, and she opened the door for me and just looked at me. And I said, just 1 minute before you say a word to me, young lady. I've been with a group of people down there in Fort Worth that tell me that I'm an alcoholic, and this book tells you all about it. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. You read it, and you leave me alone. Well, fortunately, Arbutus read the book. She studied it, but I didn't. I stayed dry for 3 months, but I didn't even read enough in that book to find out that they had AA all over the country. I thought Fort Worth bunch is the only ones that had it. So in January, that was in 1935, September 1935, in January of September 1945. In January of 46, she said, I don't know what those people had in Fort Worth, but for God's sakes, go back and get some more of it. You're unbearable. I hadn't been able to sell anything. I couldn't talk to anybody. She said anything to me, I snapped her head off. I mean, I was miserable. So I went back to Fort Worth to this little clubhouse that they'd taken me, where they'd taken me to the meeting. I walked in and I asked for John and Jim and Jack and Joe and 8 or 10 people sitting in there, and they looked at me like I'm an idiot and said, who are you talking about? And I said, well, I don't know. The guys that own this place, the men that run it, the ones that sober you up. I said, we don't know who you're talking about. You see, these 6 men, none of them had given me their name, just their first name. And to this day, I have no idea who any one of those 6 were that sat with me 3 days and night. I couldn't find them. And I sure didn't want to talk to that bunch of bums that was sitting in there. You could tell that they were no-account bums, and I didn't want to talk to them. So I went out and got drunk at them. And I continued that for the next 6 years. But I did read the book enough to know that maybe they had AA other places, and I found AA down at Austin. So I used to go down in Austin to the Austin group quite often. And I was one of these intellectuals that like to tell you how much that I knew, and you couldn't tell me anything about anything. Now, Ed Hudson founded the Austin group down there, and Ed was around it quite a lot back in the 40s, and usually you could find him there. And I'd argue with Ed about paragraphs in the book and about what it ought to be done this way and that way and all. And Ed would try to explain patiently and kindly to me what I needed to do. He said, Bill, you need to study that book. It's a textbook. You don't just read it like a dime novel. You study it. And then you do what the book tells you to do. He said, now you've been around AA since September 45, and you have never done anything about any of these steps. I said, I have too. I can quote those steps to you just like a Paul parrot, and I quoted them all to him. He said, man, just being able to quote them doesn't do you any good. You have to do what they say. You have to take these steps just like you'd take a dose of medicine and do these things, because it's only in doing these things that you are going to change. And the man you are can't do anything but drink. So you have to become a different man. I said, don't give me any of that God stuff. I'm not going to listen to it. He said, well, Bill, if you don't like the word God, put another O in it. Even a sorry one-armed drunk like you's got a little bit of good in him. So why don't you turn your life over to that good that's in you? Said, don't you know that God is the life within you? He's not on some other world up yonder or in the sky. He is within you. He is the life within you. And what you have to learn how to do is make contact with this life. I said, man, you are crazy. Here you are, a college graduate, and you're spouting stuff like that. You ought to have better sense. And I went out and got drunk at it. Sitting in there one day, this meeting house that we're in was the Hudson townhouse. The Hudsons were very wealthy. Uncle Will Miller. And Uncle John had borrowed it to go to Lubbock, this 16 miles south, and he was coming back from Lubbock. Of course, it was an old Maxwell car, and it had curtains up, and those curtains had isinglass for windows. And I shot at a bird on the fence, and this is Uncle John come by in that car, and it hit that isinglass, and of course, it exploded. Well, Uncle John thought he had a blowout. He stopped and looked at all his tires, and when he said it didn't, he looked up and saw me running towards him. I was going to tell him that Dad would put that isinglass back in for Uncle Will Miller. He jumped in that Maxwell car, he burnt rubber that quarter of a mile of town, and that night he preached a hellfire damnation sermon that he knew the devil was against him saving souls, but he didn't know he was strong enough to station two men down outside of town with a high-powered rifle to try to kill him. Well, Dad knew I was there, and Mr. Thompson knew that Ray was with me, so we both got a licking after the services that night. Next morning, I went over to Grandmother's where Uncle John was staying, and I said, you lying old hypocrite. You knew that was me, and you knew it was an air rifle. It wasn't shooting at you. And if that's the kind of man you are, and if that's the kind of God you represent, I don't want nothing to do with him or you either. Of course, I got another weapon when Grandmother told Dad about it. But I had no use for God nor any of his preachers since that day. But I went clear back to Uncle John and started, and I forgave him and released him and let him go, and all through my life. That room lit up like a million stars, the most beautiful music played I ever heard, and I dropped off to sleep just like a baby. I woke up the next morning and called Jack. Told him what had happened. He said, yes, that happened to me. He said, I want you to remember this. That is for today only. From here on out, you have to live these steps. You have to do everything these steps tell you to do daily. You can't live on yesterday's bread or tomorrow's promises. You've got to do it today. So now I suggest that from here on out, you do these things. So I started doing those things, and the miracles started happening just like the A's had been telling me for 6 years. Wasn't any time until I had bought Arbutus a big 12-room house with four baths because I had four kids. Needed every bath for every one of them, and bedrooms all galore, and I could just envision, you know, time now with 13 grandkids, what I could do with that big 12-room house. All of them would come home, have a stair rail for the 13 grandkids to slide down and all of that. And everything wonderful happened. I was going to AA meetings, and I was saving souls all over the country, and, man, I was just doing everything. Been doing this for about a year, and a cousin of mine moved back from California. His wife had been in a good Al-Anon group out there in California, and of course, as I say, Arbutus studied the book and all, but I wouldn't let her to go to the Al-Anons, and neither did she care to think to go about the Al-Anons there in Natalie. And of course, one group of them polished their fingernails, and the other group played poker. And both groups talked about their husbands and tried to describe who lived with the worst husband. And I'd hear them going through their room, you know, to get coffee. And I told her, you got no business over there at those women. But guy came back from California, and they started going to meetings with us. One night after a meeting, I'm feeling this good because I had two new babies there and all, and I'm bragging to myself. Guy reached up. She was a little gray-headed gal. She reached up and got by me and said, come in here, Buster. I want to talk to you. She took me in the living room and set me down and said, I want to tell you something. You think you're a good AA member? I said, well, I am. I've got six men over there I'm sponsoring. I go to two meetings a week in Lubbock, and I go to two meetings a week here in Abilene. She said, you are not practicing this program at home. You're not bringing it home to your wife and kids, and until you do that, you don't have the program. Oh, well, what are you talking about? So she explained to me where I wasn't practicing it at home. So I started doing that. And then I went to go into AA conventions. I heard a man say one time, we were had been talking in a group up there at the top of the Texas before the meeting started. And this one was griping about what a bad week he'd had and a bad day, and the other one, bad month and all. And the speaker that got up there said, I've just heard men around the group here since I've been here this weekend talking about how bad days they have and how rough it's been and this, that, and that. He said, evidently, down here in Texas, y'all don't study the AA program very well. Don't study the big book. Because it promises it in there emphatically that if you do these things, good things are going to happen to you. And he said, I want to tell you something. If you practice these principles in all of your affairs each day, you can't have a bad day. So when you're having a bad day, you search out and see what principles you're not practicing. Well, that stuck in my mind, and I started reviewing that, checking up on that. And you know, it made things a lot easier. He went on to say this too. He said, most of us ruin our day the first thing of a morning on our way to work. We get in our car and we start driving to work, and some old gal will come out there and she's creeping along at 5 miles an hour, and we're on the drive 30, so we get irritated and we swing around her. Or somebody runs a stoplight and we nearly hit them. And said, on our way to work in an automobile, we blow our whole day because we get irritated and angry at somebody else. And these other people don't even know that you're irritated and angry at them. It don't affect them in any way. All it does is sour your stomach and make you miserable. He said, now practice these principles in all our affairs. So I started living that way. Been just going fine, everything's going great, and my uncle down there in Brownwood, I was down visiting, and he said, Bill, you're doing good. I'm awful proud of you, and so is your auntie. But said, something I wanted to mention, you've got 4 kids to send through college, and you seem to be working nobody but drunks. See, I was back in the construction business, remodeling and siding and roofing. And my canvassers, the boys that found the jobs for me, I was sponsoring them into AA. And most of my applicators and my painters were boys that I was sponsoring into AA. I said, I've noticed that, and you're not saving any money. And if I was you, I'd go back to Union Men, and I'd quit spending so much time with these drunks. And I thought, well, Uncle Luther's a very successful man. And then I had a brother over at San Angelo who was very successful in the air conditioning and sheet metal business. He was one that always bragged, you know, he was sure proud that he had the willpower to leave this stuff alone, but he and I traveled together for 2 years one time selling clothes back in the Depression. And every time he drank over 2 beers at one sitting, he'd get violently ill. And if he drank one drink of whiskey, he'd get violently ill. He just flat could not drink it. Something about his chemistry that taste of it would make him violently ill. But he'd pat himself on the chest, I'm sure glad I had the willpower to leave that stuff alone. And he'd always give me a sermon. Why don't you do like I do? I said, well, if I didn't get this interval of pleasure when I started drinking it for a few hours or a day or two, if I got sick immediately after drinking one or two beers, well, maybe I'd do like you do. But you see, I get an interval of pleasure that you don't obtain. That's reading I drink. But anyway, I listened to them. And as my boys fell off, I hired union painters, union carpenters, quit working the canvassers, the boys that trying to make the AA program, and got me some straight men who had no drinking problem. And I'm devoting my time. I quit making so many AA meetings. Finally quit making AA meetings altogether. And I got so miserable, I didn't know what in the world was happening. I get up one morning there in Lubbock. I'm working up in Lubbock, and I'm living in Abilene. I get up there one morning, got the jobs. I don't have any painters, don't have any carpenters. I go out to another job where my siding men are working, and I ask them about where my painters, where my carpenters. We don't know anything about it. Went to Union Hall, and they said, oh, we sent them out on another job. And I said, why? And they said, well, they didn't want to work for you anymore. I went to see them in, and they said, hell, we don't have to. You're a slave driver. We don't have to work like that. We don't want to work for you. I got furious. I went, tried to hire some more men, couldn't find any. And I just packed my clothes and come back to Abilene. Got up the next morning and went down to the Drake Hotel. We had been having meetings down there on Wednesday night because the owner of the coffee shop was a member of AA, and he couldn't get closed up and get out to our meetings on Thursday night, so we'd started one there in the hotel. He furnished the coffee in the meeting room. And I went in to Lou. I said, Lou, who's chairman tonight? And he said, don't have one, Bill. I said, good, let me be chairman. I haven't been to a meeting in several months, and I need one bad. He said, we're not going to have a meeting, Bill. I said, what? He said, I'm not going to have a meeting tonight. I said, why? Well, he said, everybody quit coming, and I got tired of making the coffee sitting back there. He said, we haven't had a meeting here in over a month. I said, well, what is the matter with those people? Why'd they let the best meeting in this town die? He said, I don't know, Bill. Why did you? Oh, I was furious. I didn't want to wait till Thursday night for a meeting. I went home and raised all kinds of cane with my wife and kids, and she tried to pacify me. She boiled a big steak and fed me. I had a nightmare. She woke me up about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm wringing with sweat, and I'm shaking, and I'm crying. See, in this nightmare, I got drunk. And I called the AAs there in Abilene to come help me, and they said, we're sorry, Bill. We don't have AA anymore. Everybody quit coming. I thought I called all over the state of Texas, even called New York. And they said, we're sorry, Bill. Don't have AA anymore. Everybody quit coming. Man, I was horrified. I called one of the members there, and I said, hey, you mean to tell me that y'all have let AA die here in Abilene? He said, no, we got a meeting tonight. If I was you, I'd be there. See, God let me have that drunk in a dream. He didn't let me get a real drunk like so many of them get. Another man told me one time, said, you made a contract with God, yourself, and your fellow man, that if you could have this, you'd stay around and help others get it. And he does not release you from that contract until you die. Said, you are under an obligation to carry this to others if you want to keep it yourself. And said, the surest way to insure yourself against taking a drink is active work with another alcoholic. Now, it doesn't say that that alcoholic has to be coming off of a drunk or going on a drunk. It can be another AA member. Took me years to understand that. But you see, for my peace of mind, for my happiness, for my joy in living, I have to stay active in this. Because a man told me one time, I said, my God, man, I can't spend all my time. I can't do this all, every day. He said, well, you've got to do something all day long. You want to revert back to your old ways of living? Or had you rather live this good life? He said, all you have to do is practice these principles. Do these things daily. Instead of the old things that you're doing, you've got to do something during the day. So why not do the constructive things? Why not do what the 12 steps tell you to do? I've been practicing that for all of these years, and it has sustained me and carried me through many rough times. I went 5 years without eating. I had gallstones. The doctors that I went to there in Abilene told me that an operation wouldn't do me any good. For all my life, I'd have to be on a rigid diet and bile pills. I'd go to these conventions and live on coffee because I was afraid to eat what they had. All I could eat was a white breast of turkey that Arbutus had baked so that there'd be no grease on it. She'd lay bread out and let it dry for a week, and I'd eat that hard bread one piece a day, and that's what I lived on. John Mooney told me time and again, said, Bill, you've got gallstones. Come let me operate. I won't charge you anything for it. I said, John, Dr. Estes told me that my gallbladder was dried up. An operation wouldn't help me. He said, man, Bill, if your gallbladder was dried up, you'd be yellow as a pumpkin. Come over to Georgia. I'll take those gallstones out. And it won't cost you a dime. No. So I went 5 years without eating and in misery because my belly ached all the time. Occasionally, I'd make a slip, eat a banana or a handful of grapes, and I'd go into convulsions and stay in them for 8-10 hours, just screaming convulsions. And eventually, I'd been in convulsions for 8 or 10 hours and had a son-in-law that was a doctor. He said, I'm tired of this nonsense. Got an appointment with Dr. Falky. You go see him. Falky x-rayed me, and he said, yes, it looks like Your gallbladder's dried up. Well, we know something wrong. Let's go in there and see what it is. He went in there, and I had 5 gallstones. He removed them. I've eaten everything I wanted to eat since then. Had no more pain, which John told me was right all the time. But you see, I had believed these doctors because I had full confidence in them. So I suffered for 5 years on that belief. Then in 77, in July of 77, I had a heart attack. My daughter and wife rushed me to the hospital, and I died there in the hospital. Went through a long gray tunnel, because down at the end I could see a light, and I knew I had to get to this light. And I kept walking and walking, and I'd give out, and I'd sit down, and when I'd sit down, my 2 AAs would come up, one on each side of me, and they'd get me up, and they'd walk with me and say, "Go on." Now, I knew there's something wrong, because these AAs that were helping me were dead. But I eventually made it into that light, into the most beautiful world. It's undescribable. I was in perfect harmony with the universe, and I'm just crying for joy. And this voice came to me, and he said, "You can't stay here. You've got to go back." And I said, "Oh, no, I'm not going back. No, this is the place I want to be." He said, "Yes, you've got to go back." He said, "Your work's not done. You've got to go back and finish it." And I turned and went back to that hospital, and I came to in that hospital, and that little nurse is screaming, "He's alive, he's alive," and I'm just bawling like a baby. You see, several years before that, I had established Midwest Tape Library as a nonprofit foundation so that these tapes that I've got over 5,000 7-inch reels full of AA from all over the world, so that this could be carried on after I die and not thrown away like most tapers libraries are. I had established this and got it set up, but unfortunately I've never gotten any funding for it. And this voice had told me, he said, my work wasn't done. I had to go back and get this funding for this so that it won't be thrown away when I die. So I came back to life. And that doctor and I fought for 2 years about me taking Liberman Valium. I wouldn't take it, and he insisted I had to have it to live on. And I finally proved to him that I didn't have to, because in 79, we're in the tape room, and I'm taping, and RB just got the TV on, and they told her about a tornado that was approaching, and directly she said, "Bill, that tornado's getting close. It's hitting Vernon." And I walked outside, because I was raised in West Texas. I'd seen lots of tornadoes, and I knew that cloud boiled, and it whirled and all, and I'm standing out there looking at it, and I said, "Yeah, it's not a tornado." Kids across the street had come and gotten in our storm cellar. I'd laughed at them, told them, "Go on down there." And I'm standing there looking at it, and she screamed, "Bill, it's hit!" And about that time, I heard that freight train roar, and I hit the back door, and she's running for the front door, and I dived and tackled her and threw her down right in the living room floor and laid on her. And that house exploded. The paneling on the walls came and fell over us and kept us from getting hurt when the 2x6s and 2x4s from the rafters and all, the roof went. The ceiling joists and all fell in. Iron posts from the front porch come tumbling in the front of the house. We come crawling out from under all of that rubble and that destruction. And I looked around at it, and I'm standing up, and I'm looking down at a record that Clancy had sent me, where he's in the water up to his neck, and Chuck's standing there holding his hand out to him, and it's this. Clancy had tried to prove to Chuck that he was more spiritual than he was. He was going to walk across the water out there, and he had sunk in it, and I'm laughing. And I remembered that line that Bill had in the big book that about the Kansas farmer that come out of the cellar, and his house is blown away, and his barns are gone, and all. And he looked around, and he said, "Don't see nothing wrong here, Ma. Ain't it nice the wind quit blowing?" And Arbutus is screaming her head off. The entire house, with the exception of the tape room, is all gone. And those 5,000 tapes wasn't a reel off the shelf. The roof is gone. When it rained, even the sheetrock stayed up in that room. In all the other rooms, the sheetrock, the rafters, the studs, and the walls are gone. But not in the tape room where the tape was. A lot of people tried to explain to us that it was because of the structure of the house. This tape library was in where the garage had been. And that floor was 6 inches lower than the other floor and all. But you see, I remembered what God had said when I
died. He said, you can't stay here. You got to go back and complete your work. You've got to get that funding for that tape library. And I still have that job to do. But he left the tapes so that I could do it. He didn't destroy the tapes, everything else that we had. So we started over. I went down to see this little aunt of mine who had raised me and all, and she was blind, is blind, and was in a wheelchair and had been living there by herself for 20 years. And she's crying and saying, she couldn't stay there by herself another year. She'd have to go down to her nieces in the valley, and she didn't want to go. Well, now my son had a house in Austin that he offered to give us. My daughter had one in Sweetwater that she offered to give us. But I said, Annie, why don't Arbutus and I move in here with you? And that way you won't have to leave, and we'll have a place. Because she had a little house out there in her yard that she had rented out, and I knew I could put the tape library out there. So that's what we did in 79. We moved to Brownwood. So I'm back in the bed I was in when I was a boy, 14 years old, in the house that I was in when I was 14 years old. I made a complete circle. I'm back home. She's still living. She was 99 years old yesterday, still enjoying life, and we're all happy. And thank God we have a program called Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a pleasure being with you. Thank you.